RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
Welcome to RDI Insights. Slightly different, as this has been recorded during the lockdown due to the coronavirus pandemic. With the previous 48 interviews, I've always been in the room with my guests, but today I'm 150 miles away, so apologies for the occasional glitch in sound quality. Ben Terrett is the first service designer to be made an RSA Royal Designer for Industry. The design discipline is a relatively new area that has found its effectiveness in the digital age. A project that highlights this is gov.uk, a one-stop website that brings all government departments together for the public to engage with in a fast, easy-to-understand way. It was a four-year-long project that my guest today headed up as design director. Gov.uk has become an exemplar of how 21st century public bodies should communicate with its often vast audiences. The many complex issues involved need collaboration of teams of people from differing technical areas, all led by a service design director to orchestrate the team to an end goal. And that's where my guest today's expertise comes in. So the first question I asked Ben was, what is service design?
The simplest definition is that service design is the design of services, whereby we mean the end-to-end service from start to finish. And to fully understand that, you need to understand what we mean by a service. And what we mean by a service is something that helps somebody get something done. So typically completing a task or sometimes finding pieces of information. And I think the big thing that's, you're right, Mike, that the term is new really, but the sort of concept probably isn't. And what's made it really come to the fore in the 21st century is I think that lots of static products, if you like, and I don't just mean physical things, I mean other things as well, because of the internet, they've become connected to the internet, and then they have this almost continuous life rather than a, you know, you buy it and you forget about it. And that's meant the service behind that product is now suddenly much more important. You know, Apple Computer is a really good example. They've gone from purely selling physical products to selling more and more services. And that's meant that the design of those services is suddenly much more important.
And I think also the ability to evolve and change quickly is one of the strengths of service design because of the nature of the world you inhabit, which is very much the digital world. So I know, reading about you recently, that you know this particular situation we're in at the moment with the coronavirus has not stopped you working at all. Indeed, you've been helping organizations around the world to communicate latest things and structures about the virus. So if ever there was a profession that is suited to this kind of drama, it seems to be service design.
Yes, I think so. I mean, we've been working, we're all working remotely. That's the first thing. The switch, I mean, as everyone is, but the switch for us was quite simple because about 80% of our current projects were remote anyway.
Yeah.
And we're very used to working with that. And we were working with the Californian government, and we pivoted all of that work to be about the coronavirus response. And in that particular instance, the very first thing is the service is information. It's allowing citizens to find where is the trusted resource of clear, regularly updated information. Designing that information and publishing that information is relatively simple. The hard part of that task is you have to move at such a speed that you have to navigate all the government departments who would ordinarily have a say in that information. You know, in like which department publishes that, which website does it go on, all that kind of stuff, where the hard work is. And that's where the end-to-end aspect of the service becomes really important. The user, for example, doesn't care which department publishes this information. They just want to know, you know, is it safe for my family to go to the park?
And getting real information coming from the right sources, because there are so many misleading things out there, particularly in America at the moment, that I'm sure the necessity to find the truth rather than, you know, all of these crazy theories is pretty vital. I want to talk more fully about service design and your company and what you do a little later, but I want to start by winding back, really, to the young Ben. So where were you born, Ben?
I was born in Swindon, in Wiltshire, which is an incredibly unglamorous answer to that question, actually, Mike, but that's the truth. My parents and my grandparents were all from Gloucestershire, and I lived the first few years of my life in Gloucestershire, and then we moved to Wiltshire, and I basically stayed in Wiltshire until I went to university.
So what sort of background would you say that was?
A very standard English middle-class background, Mike. My father was a sales representative for an oil company, and my mum was a fundraiser for a series of charities as a professional fundraiser. Neither of those had any interest in art or design or anything like that. But if you step back a generation, my grandfather and his father, so my great-grandfather, were both engineers, and they had an engineering company in Gloucestershire called FH Territ, which was a sort of steel fabrication engineering company. So they made windmills and water wells and things like that. My grandfather was a very skilled draftsman as part of that, and he also painted watercolours at the weekend and so on and so on. And, I've not thought too much about it, but I think you can see there a thread of both design, but also a very functional side of design, which is what I've always been much more interested in.
No, I can quite see that. And what about siblings?
I have one brother called Michael, who now lives in the US and is a policeman.
All right. Okay.
So very different.
Very different, yes. And what about, your early interest? From what I can imagine, you're saying that maybe there was not any creative stimulus around you within the home?
No, there wasn't, Mike. It's a really interesting question, I think, because I try and do work now with sort of secondary school kids, and I think this is relevant for them. So there wasn't any, and my parents weren't artists or designers. One of my uncles was a graphic designer, became a graphic designer, but later on in my life, he was quite young for an uncle, so I didn't experience that until quite later. So there was no direct stimulus, but my parents never stopped me. So they never, which I think is the important bit here, and is the kind of gift they gave me, if you like. They never stopped any of my interest in the arts or the creative industry, which I think you see a lot of now. And from a very early age, I was always drawing, I was always sketching. I would draw on any piece of paper I could find. I would make little comics or do all those things.
When you say early, what, 6 years, 7 years?
From as early as I can remember. Four or five or six. From as early as I can remember, I was, stick men doodling, drawing, colouring, but always kind of making art things. And that turned into drawing and sketching and making little books and, like I say, comics and maybe the odd poster.
When you went to your junior school, did you find there at the school that someone encouraged you and helped you, directed you?
That's a very good question, Mike. Yes, they did. They didn't initially, but towards my last year in primary school, possibly the year before, my last year in primary school, when I was young, I suffered very bad from hay fever and in the summer, like so bad that I would have to stay inside. And this stopped me doing any kind of PE or sports, which although I enjoy now, I didn't enjoy when I was younger, actually. So. Yeah. I was always looking for ways, to get out of PE and not do that. And in my last year at primary school, they did it was a tiny primary school in Wiltshire. They only had about 100 kids in it, but they did a big stage production. And so I ended up painting all the stage scenery. And this was quite a seminal moment in my life. Like, I remember painting this big train station, kind of landscape backdrop, pretty much single-handedly, actually.
Yeah.
And designing it and painting it. And I remember the teacher at the time being incredibly impressed that I wanted to do this and I was able to do it all on my own. I didn't think anything of it at all. It just felt very easy to me and the most obvious thing in the world to do. Somebody make this scenery, might as well be me. But I remember everyone in this thing quite amazed, including my mum and dad, all quite amazed. But that was a very enjoyable and sort of proud moment in my early days.
So did you then go on to the 11 plus?
No, I went to a comprehensive secondary school.
Okay.
In Wiltshire. And they had an art department. They had a sort of woodworking. It was still called woodworking then. And
yes.
We would make, candlestick holders.
I know it well. I went to a secondary modern school as well and spent a long time in the woodwork department and the metalwork department. So what did that lead you to, these woodworking classes? Yeah. How did you sort of...
It's a very interesting question, Mike, because in fact, until I was much, much older, I didn't realise you had a choice of school, because everybody in my primary school basically went to the same secondary school. And I think I'm right in saying there were no grammar schools in Wiltshire, I think. So you didn't really have much choice in independent or private schools, but that wasn't an option. And so we did woodworking, which I loved, and we did art, which I also loved. I think woodworking got closed down while I was there. actually, but art stayed. And there was a very good art teacher who was very exuberant, and but he had this saying, which is art is not parrots. And he would occasionally scream this at the pupils: art is not parrots, art is not parrots. And I think lots of people used to laugh it off, but what he meant by that was art is not just visual. There is meaning behind art sometimes. And if you're making a piece of art that is purely visual, you know, that's not what we're trying to do here. And I remember that striking a chord with me. There's then a very important moment when I was about 13. And back in when I was at school, you basically were told to choose a career for your GCSEs and maybe A-levels from that. And I went to the library, and there was, when I was, would have been about 13, and before I chose my GCSE options, you were basically told to choose a career and then plot your GCSEs from that, maybe A-levels and so on. And they had a book, I remember, like a small ring binder, sort of a third of the height of an A4 ring binder that I think was maroon. And it, and you flipped through it, and it had careers in it. And I flipped through them all. None of them got me that excited, apart from one that I remember at the time was called Advertising Artist. And that was the only one that was vaguely creative. And I was at a stage in my life where I loved drawing. I loved drawing, but I sort of knew somehow that art, being an artist, wasn't quite right, because I probably didn't know at the time, but I liked, I don't know whether it was business or function or something about the world, but I knew that I wasn't going to be just an artist. That wasn't it. And this thing that said advertising artist basically said, I think we would call it art worker now if we were rewriting that description, but it said people come up with ideas and they give them to you and you sketch them up and then they get made into adverts. And I thought, that sounds great, that sounds wonderful, that sounds like a bit like what I'm doing now, but you get a job in it, sounds brilliant. So I went to see the careers person and said, I'd like to do this. And they sort of said, oh, okay, well, we don't get many people doing that. But we did some digging. And that's where I learned that you need to do, you know, art at GCSE and then art and something else at A-level. And then you would go to foundation course and then you would go and do a degree in, you know, graphic design probably. And so I remember this very clearly. And I went home that day and said to my mum and dad, right, I've decided what I want to do and I've worked out a route and this is it. I want to do these GCSEs, Salient Foundation and all this. And they just stared at me blankly and then said, okay, fine. And I said, I don't think you have to do anything, but I suppose you might have to pay for something at some stage. Is that all right? And they kind of said, I think so, yes. And that was kind of it. And I know since, having spoken to my parents, that my mum said they were terrified by this because they didn't see how you could get a job and make a living in art. My parents didn't go to university, so they had no idea of this world. They were quite, not terrified, but, you know, they were quite unsure about the prospect. But she said, you seem so absolutely determined that we just thought probably best to not get in his way. Seems like he knows what he's doing. Let's just let him get on. Therefore, the path was set.
Yes. So tell me then how that journey continued.
I also assumed that everyone did that. So I assumed that everyone at 13 sort of had an idea of what they wanted to do, made those decisions, and then stuck to that path. I now know that basically nobody does that, you know, and it was incredibly rare. And I guess I was incredibly lucky that I found something that I enjoyed and struck a chord with me. And, you know, so like you know, you're still doing your hobby for a living, which is the greatest thing. They did for my year only, but they did a graphic design GCSE at my school, which is, I think, what replaced the woodwork thing. We got a new headmaster who had, you know, modern ideas, and there was a graphic design GCSE, which was pretty simple logos and, you know, taking an existing logo and redesigned it. And I enjoyed that. I have to say, I didn't enjoy it massively, but I did enjoy it. And then I did an art GCSE as well. And then I went to A-level school, which was another school across the road. And from there, I did A-levels in art with art history, photography, and business studies.
So this is sort of sixth form, was it? Sort of equivalent to sixth form.
Yes, this was a sixth form. Yeah. And I did art, photography, and business studies. I knew that art and design wasn't enough. There was another side, and whether that's business or what, you know, I don't think I knew. But I thought that business studies would be a good idea, and I enjoyed business studies very much. And photography was quite an odd choice, I think, as an A. It was very new as an actual A level, I think. So I did both of those, and then at Trowbridge College in Wiltshire, they had a very, very well respected foundation course. It was run by a wonderful chap called Mike Rennie. I don't know what's happened to him, but it had a very good reputation and would get people into Central St Martins and all kinds of other places. And I did my A levels, which I enjoyed very much, but I think I didn't get the grade that I wanted or I needed. I certainly I didn't I got very marked down in my photography A-level. And the teacher told me at the time that for my final project, I'd taken all these pictures of my dad having some dental work done. And we were all very pleased with them. But the tutor said, I think basically you've scared the examiners. You know, it's too gruesome a subject. Then what they're expecting is portraiture and, you know, landscapes and things. And you've taken these, you know, quite strange pictures of your dad having his dental work done. So, you know, I think that's scuppered you a bit. Anyway, because of that, I didn't initially get on to the foundation course. They gave me a reserve, quite upset about this. But the photography teacher went to see the foundation teacher and said, this guy has got a great portfolio and the grades don't match up. And he's also always in, you know, he's always in the photography studio. He's always staying behind. He's always doing all the work. I really think you should put him on. And so because of that, I got a place on the foundation course. And I have to say the foundation course, although I'd sort of set a path, I think the foundation course is the bit that changed my life, really, because it was the most wonderful year of my educational life. You know, it was just incredible.
So that was a sort of year of discovery, really, probably in all of those various little disciplines you found yourself.
Yeah,
so what
exactly?
What area did you really sort of submerge yourself in?
Well, it was graphics. I mean, the way it worked was you did two terms of everything and then the final term you specialised. And our foundation course, you basically got set pretty much one brief a day, sometimes a brief for a week, but they were very keen on these very quick briefs, and you did everything from textiles, photography, fine art. And I think at the time I was getting a bit more interested in fine art again, but you know, and we did that at foundation and it was great fun. But when we started doing the graphics, that's when I really settled on that, and I thought, no, this is more like it. This is closer to, I suppose, the commerce side or the business side. This feels more like what I'm interested in. And there's another moment, Mike, around about the same time, a little bit earlier actually, probably just winding back a few years, probably when I was doing my GCSEs, when you'll remember this, there was an exhibition at the Royal Academy which was called Monet in the 90s.
Yes.
A very famous exhibition.
Yes.
In fact,
yes.
I think it's still the Royal Academy's third best or second best selling exhibition or something. But that exhibition happened, and I said to my mum that I would really love to go. You know, I was a big fan of Monet at the time. And we went. I think it was probably my first ever time to London, certainly central London. Mum and I went. I think we went on the bus and we went to the exhibition, and I absolutely loved it. I loved every bit of it. And, you know, we had a great day and then we came home. And again, Mum said to me since that, she said, when we went to that exhibition, you were absolutely transfixed by the paintings, and I've never really seen that in you. And you said to me that you couldn't believe you were stood in front of these famous paintings and how amazing they were. And she said, that's when I really realised we don't have to worry about this art thing. You know, this really is, this creative thing is his passion, you know, and he'll be fine.
Excellent.
So that one exhibition was also a sort of changing moment.
So after the foundation, you went on to uni?
Yes, went to De Montfort University, which is a strange choice, really, and I don't to this day really know how I ended up there. And I say that because I didn't put enough effort into choosing university, and I'm lucky enough to be on the board of university now. I'm on the board of UAL, and I know how important it is and how different the courses and the colleges are. And I didn't really spend that much time, and I think really, Mike, this is, you know, where you fall down if your parents haven't been to university, for example. You don't know enough about it, and you don't know enough about the system and so on. So the things I was looking for was I wanted to do graphics, but I didn't want to do pure graphics. I wanted something else. And I thought that maybe graphics and 3D was the thing. And so with the tutors at Foundation, we looked very hard for a course that did graphics and 3D. And there were, I seem to remember, they were three: Middlesex, Sheffield and De Montfort. And De Montfort was the one that I kind of got into. And then, so I ended up in De Montfort, which is fine. And then during the summer, they wrote to us and said, basically De Montfort University have bought Lincoln College of Art, and we're moving all the graphics courses to Lincoln. And so therefore you won't be going to Leicester, which is where De Montfort is based. You'll be going to Lincoln. And me, you know, me being a you know, naive young boy from Wiltshire kind of meant nothing to me. But actually, it was a big change for the university. And what it meant was that we were very lucky in that Lincoln was very much an art school, art college, very informal, studio-based, you know, tutors there all day, you go and hang out. And university was already on this path to not being like that and being kind of more modules and things. But because they bought Lincolnshire College of Art, they basically got an injection of cash from De Montfort University. And so we turned up and we had this very nice art school vibe, but with great facilities. So there were loads of Apple Macs, for example. It was very easy to get on a computer, which it wasn't at the time anywhere else. And so that was great. Although, because of the changes, it meant that our studio or our college was based on the top floor of a co-op department store, which obviously has relevance later on in my story.
So you left, but I think before doing that, did you entered the RSA Student Design Awards?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I did.
And you were selected as a winner in one of the categories.
Right.
That's in 1997. So that obviously took quite an effort in terms of agreeing to, because I know from having judged them many, many times over the years, a lot of students at that time are working on their own diplomas themselves, their own end of year stuff. And so to go on to do the RSA award as well is a sort of additional piece of work, if you like, separate from what you're doing at college. So just tell me a little about that project, because I think hook up with where you eventually started to move.
Well, I loved being at university. I loved doing design all day, every day. Obviously I loved friends and the social aspects and all that kind of stuff, but I really loved the course, and we had some great tutors, and I soaked up everything, and you know, I loved working on every project. And so for me, when all the briefs, really, RSA, DNAD, the other kind of student competitions, I was into all of them. You were only allowed to enter one, I think, because like you say, it's a lot of work. And myself and one or two other, we had a very small tutor group, which was great. We had about 38 people in the year. And myself and one or two others had become more and more interested in digital technology. And we had a tutor who was also very interested in it. And this wasn't an official kind of module or part of the course. It was a bit more like a hobby. And we used to stay behind and work on learning new programs. And there were two big ones at the time, one called Director and one called Apple Media Tools, which allowed you to make kind of clickable animations and things. The web obviously existed and there were a few websites, but we didn't really do any of that. But we did these kind of clickable interactive, you know, CD-ROM type things. Yeah. So we did lots of work and we started experimenting with that. And one of the RSA projects had an interactive element to it. And so that's the one I opted for. That's the one I went for. And put a lot of time into it. And the project was, I'll oversimplify the brief when I remember it, but it was effectively communicate a innovation program to a government audience. Uh-huh. And it was about education, I think. And so I just devised this little clickable thing where the different words like education was spelt out in numbers, where the numbers had been turned around. So a 3 represents an E and so on and so on. And I devised this whole alphabet. And then as you clicked on the numbers, they turned into letters, and then it told you more things. And I made this little sort of CD-ROM type program and entered it in and was lucky enough to win, yes.
And then after that, obviously, you graduated. And from my research, you worked at various small design groups initially as a graphic designer. And then in 2001, you started the Design Conspiracy, which is sort of providing graphics and digital work, and that lasted 7 years. So obviously during the course of that 7 years you bedded into the daily grind of graphic design, and I think that you were also getting much more involved in digital work.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we did the thing I think that's very stereotypical of British graphic designers, which is you form a consultancy with your friends from college and you do logos and album covers and the odd thing. I mean, I think I say that, I think there's a generation of graphic designers that all do that. And so we did that, and we had a really great time, and we learned so much, as you know, Mike, when you start your own business, you really are at the sharp end. And you learn everything from client handling to VAT returns and all that stuff. And we got to about 12 people, I think, which for a small British graphic
Not
design
bad.
Company is quite quite a large size. And we had, in the last couple of years, maybe sort of 3 or 4 years when I was there, we'd done some web digital projects we did one for the Arcadia group with Topshop and so on, and we did 3 or 4 for the South Bank Centre, which we really enjoyed. They were great to work with and they were great projects. And we'd built this sort of little team of me leading them, one of my partners and colleagues as the sort of designer, and then one or two developers that we would use on a freelance team. But we had the core there of a good little team that were building these projects. And to cut a long story short, there were 5 of us who were the sort of shareholders, if you like, in the company. And I kind of said, look, we really, really need to go down this digital route and go all in and do much more of this digital work. And the others just didn't want to do that. They wanted to do, they said, which is true, well, websites, you know, can be a real pain and it's very complicated, which is true. Yeah. And we would like to stick to the more traditional stuff, you know. And so, you know, we had a discussion and I said, well, I mean, we could argue about this for ages and maybe I could convince you all, but that's not really what anybody wants.
Well, and indeed, you went off to a completely different area. You went into advertising and worked for the agency of Iden and Kennedy. And must have been a big step change because advertising is a completely different world from graphics.
Yeah.
And you're dealing with much larger clients. You have far greater influence because of the nature of the work and the amount of money involved in media spend and all of that. So how did you find that world?
Yeah, it's interesting that you phrase it like that, Mike, because you're right, but I think Wyden and Kennedy are different. And
yes, they were one of the newer agencies that came up at the time, along with Mother and a few others that were trying to do things differently.
Yes, and they are genuinely passionate about design.
Mm.
And I think lots of ad agencies aren't.
Yeah.
And lots of ad agencies have a very superficial view on design. Wyden and Kennedy didn't. They were very, very design-led, and they placed a great value on design. And immediately after the design conspiracy, I didn't know what I wanted to do, actually. I just knew that it wasn't that. So I was freelancing, effectively. And I ended up freelancing quite regularly for Wyden and Kennedy. And I was doing sort of digital projects or projects where digital and advertising crossed over.
Mm.
And then I also ended up being the creative director on the Guardian press account, because that was a very design driven, you know, account as well. There's a very strong design sense to the Guardian. So I ended up working there. And you're right, it is very different. But I have to say, and Wyden and Kennedy is famously kind of crazy, both externally and internally, and all of that is true. But I absolutely loved working there. They were wonderful people, and they really, really are a genuinely creative business. I think it frustrates the account people, and so, you know, extraordinarily, because creativity is given such prominence. And the clients know that too. You know, it really is an agency where the creative work comes first. It was nice to work in that for a bit.
But you also actually were doing things outside of Wyden and Kennedy. And one that's, I think, an interesting story is your funding, or getting funding via, I think, Channel 4 or something like that, the Paper Club. Now, just explain to listeners what the Paper Club was and what you'd recognised in, if you like, the paper industry that they were not doing, where there was a real possibility.
Yes. So, like I say, I was sort of freelancing at the time and doing a few other projects. And with my now sort of longtime collaborator, Russell Davis, he's a strategist and a writer, kind of ad man turned blogger is what I often describe him as. He has the blog that I'm sure you'd be aware of, Mike.
Yes.
I'm sure you'd have come across it. Him and I did lots of interesting projects, and we would do freelance work, and then we would put some of the money aside to do interesting things. And one of the things we wondered was, you know, how easy is it to print a newspaper? And also, we said, this particular year, lots of our friends have written very interesting blog posts, and we'd like to share those with other people, but we want something more than just emailing the links around and, you know, how can we do that? And so we rang around a series of newspaper printers and, you know, sort of said, can I print 100 newspapers, please? And most of the time, they would just hang up. If you were lucky, they would laugh at you before they hung up. But, you know, they really weren't interested at all. And eventually we found someone who would print 10,000, I think, or something of that order, which was the smallest we could get done. So we did that, and we gave about 1,000 away to kind of friends and contact, and just said, look, here's some blog posts we've liked over the years. We've you know, I laid them out in InDesign. You know, we laid them out and we made this newspaper. We called it Things Our Friends Have Written on the Internet. And we sent it out and we said, you know, if you like it, spread the word, tell others. And overnight, really, or over 2 or 3 days, it was an incredible success on social media. And people sort of wrote to us and said, can I get one? Of course, we had another 9,000 or so in the office. So we said, yeah, I suppose if you send us your name and address, you can. And so we were then inundated with names and addresses. We completely underestimated how much it would cost to post newspapers to New Zealand and America and all over the world. Yes. But we took that on the chin and we sent all these newspapers out. But it was really, really successful beyond anything we can imagine. And that's when we thought, okay, maybe there's something in this. And so we had a small sort of venture capital fund at the time, and we approached them, and you know, we said we think we can turn this into a business. The idea, the kind of pitch idea, is you'd be able to say, click, turn my blog into a newspaper, and then post it to somebody. That was the kind of initial idea, and we did kind of achieve that, and then we received some funding, we started the business, and it's still going to this day. I'm not involved anymore. We sold our stake 4 or 5 years ago, and that we used 4 or 5 different printers. By now, the printers, by the way, had been convinced of, okay, well, you know, we can print 10,000 or 1,000 at a time, but actually this company's giving us quite a lot of orders, so we can get the economics to work, and you can, and then digital printing presses for newspapers started to come to the fore at the time. So now you can print one newspaper or 10 or 20.
Yes, it's astonishing.
Which is great. And one of the printers that we used, their father was a very successful printer in the East Midlands, and their father had sort of retired and gave the business to his two sons. And they contacted us and said, you know, you're becoming quite a large part of our business, so we would like to, you know, invest in you and take it forward. And now they're heavily involved, which is great. But there's a team in Glasgow that run it. They're still operating throughout the lockdown and the virus, and pretty much every newspaper you see at an art gallery, yes, or a student show or something like that is printed by a newspaper.
I know, astonishing. Yeah, I've noticed that. Well, that project earned you the Design Museum's 2014 Design of the Year, or one of the Design of the Year in a particular category.
That's right. We didn't win the overall one, but won the category for graphic, I think.
And then we're moving on now to the serious business, the meat, if you like. In 2011, you joined the Government Digital Services Department as Design Director, where you probably took on, probably still, I think, one of your greatest challenges to revolutionise the government.
That's very interesting.
A little bit about that project.
Yes. Let me tell you how that came about first, because it's just an interesting story. So I'd just been made design director at Wieden Kennedy London, which, as I said, I was full-time there by the time. And I loved the company, I loved the agency, I loved all the people there. And I'd been, I don't know, director for 3 or 4 months. And the agency had just been through a tough time, lost a big client, but was coming out of that. And it was quite exciting. And then somebody that I knew, Tom Loosemore, who I now work with, but I didn't know very well at the time, contacted me and said, we need a designer for this government thing. You know, basically we're redesigning DirectGov. We need somebody to help out. You know, do you know anybody? And I said, oh, I don't know. You know, let me recommend. Doesn't sound, you know, if you're honest, that doesn't sound that exciting. I'll recommend a few people. Anyway, I kept recommending people and he kept emailing back and saying, no, no, no. And then eventually I said, look, oh, I'm sending you really good people and you keep saying no. So something's wrong here. Maybe we should meet for a coffee and have a chat. And we met for a coffee, and he told me then about the broader project, the broader kind of transformation project. And I said, oh, okay, now I understand where you're going wrong. You basically asked me to find you somebody who could redesign DirectGov, you know, and push some pictures around and make it look nice. But that's not what you need. You need somebody who thinks about it much more like a system, you know, like the Calvert and Kinnear road signs, or like the underground map or something. You need somebody who talks about it like roads and railways, rather than, you know, you're not going to get anywhere if you go and talk to people about web design. It has to be this sort of design system thinking. So I said, just find somebody that does that and hire them, you know, and that's fine. And he just looked at me and said, but I'm not, I've met all these designers. None of them talk like that whatsoever, just you. And then there was a long pause and I sort of said, I've just talked myself into the job, haven't I? And he said, you have a bit, yeah. And I said, okay, let's talk about this. And obviously it was, you know, I went from an advertising agency salary to a civil servant salary. We were all just you know, regular civil servants. So there was quite a significant pay cut involved. But, you know, the more I went over to talk to the people, the more you got the size of the mission, you know, the size of the scope of the project, and you sort of, you did think this is really exciting. And then two things really made my mind up to do the job. And I remember the Wieden and Kennedy were very shocked when I told them. And the two things were, I went to a small event that Francis Maude, who was our minister, and Martha Lane Fox, who'd written the initial report that kicked off the work, went to a small event that they were at, and they both spoke, and they both talked about the user and user centricity and design, these kind of things. And I thought, wow, they're not reading a press release. They really believe this. And that was really important to me. And then in the same week, I think, I went to the Kenneth Grange exhibition at the Design Museum. Mm-hmm. And what really struck me there was how Ken had designed just everyday things, just ordinary everyday things that were well designed. And some of them were government and public sector, but some of them weren't, you know, razors and cameras and things. but they were all just ordinary things in ordinary people's lives. And I actually thought that's actually been an ambition of mine for a long time, is just to design ordinary things that ordinary people can say, yeah, I used that and it was really great, you know, and it helped my life. And those two things made me think, yeah, this is the one for me.
That's a very interesting point, because I think the notion of the involvement of the human, you know, human-centered things, it's something that many designers actually don't really think about. I think design quite often is a very selfish profession, and it's all about, look what I've done. I think, you know, one of my own personal, and I'd be interested in your view, is architecture. I'm a great believer in people-centered architecture. So person is the most important thing, the user. And so many buildings are not, they're statements. They're about wealth and dominance, and to make you feel intimidated. And a great swathe of London is turning into that sort of thing. So I think that, you know, that's one of my key hate is architecture that couldn't give a damn about the people using it.
I think you're right, Mike. I think you can say the same about design in general, to be honest. Too much of it looks like users never encountered it until long after it launched. And I kind of knew this and believed this, but the first time I really experienced it in a big, all-encompassing way was in the government, where we went all in on user centricity. That was the answer to every question. And, you know, that needs to be careful. You're not talking about kind of group design and crowdsourcing the design, you're talking about that. So it needs to be very carefully shepherded and led. That's where the skill comes in, I think. But really focusing on what is the user trying to do, that's how you get successful design, I think.
Well, that project obviously put you on the map in terms of the sheer number of awards that you got, DNAD, Design Week, various awards. Suddenly your name was banded about. You knew what you were about, and you took up a job as head of design with the Co-op. Now, the Co-op had gone through a really bad patch in terms of its image. You know, it had a, if I remember correctly, the managing director was involved.
The chairman, yes.
And the chairman involved in drug taking and
all kinds of scandals.
And the Co-op itself had lost its core values, its place in society as a person that embraced the locality of where it was and so forth.
Yeah.
And your job was not only to bring that back, but to give it a much more refreshed look, harking back to the use of its original Co-op logo, as opposed to the cumbersome The Cooperative, which had been used up until that point. And, you know, I drop into the local Co-op often, and I witnessed the change by being a weekly customer. Suddenly all these things started to happen. You know, the staff were behaving differently. There were messages about local charities and community functions, and there were donations to be given to this cause and that cause. And they seem to have taken a lot of advice and still continue to use it. Now, that was in 2015. We're now in 2020, and it's very wedded in. So that was and that then led you on to where we are now with you. In 2018, did you start?
Yes,
Public
that's right.
Digital?
Yeah, the start of 2018.
Yeah. Yes. And so we're now in this situation where you are taking great job that you were responsible for, along with many collaborators, of course, but you very much leading, going around the world now. Tell me a little about the makeup of Public Digital, how it is in terms of a business. You know, do you have a building? Do you have a place? Are you scattered around the world? How does it work? This is a 21st century way of working.
There's a good question, Mike, and I think you and whoever's listening to this might be surprised by some of the answers. So we are very definitely a collection of people all around the world. We have a core staff of about 15, and then we have a network, which we call our affiliates network, of about 40 people. And the network are the people that are based all around the world, and they are contractors or freelancers, you might call them, who, you know, have other projects, but we keep them linked together, and we do kind of events where they can speak to each other and so on. So it genuinely is a network. And then when we need to, we say, well, look, there's a potential project here in Australia, say, you know, do you think three or four of you in the region can get together and do it? Or maybe you're working remotely, it doesn't matter. But we kind of put teams together like that. Now, some of those people we might, you know, work with once every 2 years or something, but other people we might have a, you know, say a 3-month project with a particular period. So there are different kind of scales, but that's how it works. We don't really have any UK clients because the core of what we do is, you know, public sector government transformation. Obviously,
and you've kind of done that.
Either your view is we've done it, or you don't want to, you know, get involved with your, you know, leave your predecessors to get on their own kind of thing. So we do some work in the UK, and we do private sector work, but the kind of private sector work we do is companies like the co-op, where there is a public purpose, you know, to what they're doing. And yeah, we like working at scale. The bigger and the more complicated the problem, the more interested we are. That fits the bill for all government. But we, in fact, just yesterday, I wrote a note to the team, and we are currently working in Australia, Belize, Brussels, Canada, Greece, Jamaica, Madagascar, Poland, Uganda, and, like I said, California.
And this would always be, because of the nature of projects like this and the sheer number of people involved and therefore the costs, you're dealing with pretty high-level people.
Yes. I mean, we have a saying, which is we like to work with the presidents and the practitioners. And that's because we believe very strongly that you need a mandate and you need a movement. And so you need a big senior leader like the prime minister or maybe the minister, who can, you know, wield some sticks from time to time and is brought into the project. That's never enough. You need the people on the ground who are also doing the work. And what you want to try and avoid is the people in the middle who gum this up, who Peter Drucker, the famous management consultant, called it the frozen middle.
Right.
You know, and that's the bit you need to try and avoid.
Now, outside of all of this, your daily job, which I know is very busy because you're dealing with people around the world, you schedule your time and, you know, I know we scheduled this call because you have lots of meetings, Zoom or otherwise, lots of people. But you also...
Well, we operate in lots of time zones.
Yes, exactly.
I'm the sort of CEO and the leader. I often have to, you know, operate in all of them. So, for example, this morning we had somebody did a workshop in Australia, which was 7 a.m. UK time. And then somebody else is doing a similar thing on the west coast of Canada, which finishes at 11 p.m. Tonight. So, you know, we really are sort of working all around the clock. So.
Yes. Yes. In other words, what I'm saying is you're a very busy man, but later this year you pick up the presidency of DNAD, which having done that myself many years ago when the organization was a lot smaller than it is now, that's quite a task. So you're being stretched. You need a lot of elasticity, I think, in your daily working life.
Yes, I'm also on the, like I say, I'm a governor of University of the Arts London, which is, you know, Central St Martin's Jazz College of Arts Centre.
Well, there are lots of other things too, unless you've dropped them all. You're a member of the advisory board of the London Design Festival. I don't know whether that's... You're a member of the HS2 design panel.
Yes.
So, you know, all of these things take time. So something's got to give, I would have thought. But what I wanted to talk about, because I know it's something that interests you, before we round up, and that's design education in this country. And you touched on it a little bit about your own early days of not knowing what was good and what was bad. You had no guidance. So what's your driving passion about design education in this country?
It's a very great question. I'm glad you asked it. I think you, if you're a reasonable human being, you have to be interested in education. It really is the only way to solve, you know, the world's myriad of problems, really. Education at every levels, and it's so vital for young kids. And, you know, we're lucky in the UK, but, you know, many, many other countries don't have anywhere near the level of education that is available in the UK. You know, I know that. I've been to, you know, schools in Madagascar and different countries and so on. So I think I am very passionate about that. And I'm very passionate about creative education because, firstly, it's diminishing and almost gone in many schools in the UK. You know, it really has gone from the agenda, and series of funding cuts have meant, and you know, the big problem in the UK is it doesn't get you anything in an Ofsted report, so it's the first thing to go if money gets cut, because it doesn't, Ofsted don't count it, which unlocks more funding and so on. So there's a systemic problem there. But leaving that aside for 1 minute, because I think that's, you know, I'm not a politician, but the other sort of problem I think is, like me, many kids, you know, love drawing, love being creative, but either don't sort of realize you can get a job out of that, or don't understand. They think they know you can get a job out of it, but they just, the missing link is, how do I get there, you know, and how do I do that? And I think probably universities do a good job of explaining it, but it's too late, because lots and lots of research shows that it is round about the age of 12 and 13 where you start making your mind up and heading in a direction, and schools don't do a great job of explaining it.
No, true.
And so I have been doing some work via the Sorrel Foundation, going into secondary schools and kind of talking to them about this when they're about to choose their options. And two things have really struck me. Well, three, I suppose. One is they've often never met a designer. They haven't, and they have a very, you know, stereotypical idea of what that person is like. And I probably don't fit that stereotype. But they've often never met one. And secondly, the first question they ask you is, what, how much can you earn? And, you know, I always say, well, look, here's some, you can get figures for that now, and here's some figures, and, you know, they're fairly standard. But, you know, also, probably the richest designer in the world is Jonathan Ive. And, you know, I have no idea how much he's worth, but if he's not a billionaire, I imagine he's probably close to it, once he counts all his Apple, you know, shares. So if that's what your mum and dad are worried about, and lots of mum and dads are worried about that, you know, you can point to that or something. But, you know, they always ask that question. And another thing I've discovered, particularly with the older ones, when they are sort of 17, 18, lots of them will say, I'm very good at maths, or I'm very good at history or something. And, you know, I've been offered a place at this wonderful university. But my real passion is art, or maybe playing the flute, or maybe dance, or maybe something like that. And I could get on a course that does that, really. But I'm torn between the two. What do you think? And I think when they're 18, 19, you know, they need to make their own minds up. And so what I found myself saying is, I think this is the moment where you need to commit fully. And the first, because I think a career in the creative industries does involve you fully committing to it, and does involve you putting your heart and soul into it. And it's a lot more personal, I think, than other careers. You know, it's very hard to leave it behind when you close the door, because it's a passion as well as a career. So, you know, I think you need to commit. And one of the first things you need to do is, you know, go home and tell mum and dad that you don't want to do maths, you want to do dance. And maybe if you can't do that, you know, if you can't tell the people that love you the most in the world, then, you know, maybe it's not as much of a passion as you think it is. And I don't know, they tell me that's helpful.
Well, that's very good advice for very young people that have maybe just the beginnings of an idea in their minds. But what about those young designers now who are in the creative industry struggling because their education has been put on hold? They don't quite know what's going to happen. It's been massively disrupted because of the COVID-19. There, I've got two daughters. One is at Slade and the other one is going to go to the Royal Academy. And in both cases, there's an unknown whether they're starting in September or whether it's going to be Christmas. And ultimately, you know, these young people are looking forward to coming out into the world and getting a job. What do you have, any pearls of wisdom for those that have worked hard for the past 3 years? And maybe some of them are going on to an MA, but even so, they all want to know how it's done, what happens next.
I don't think the advice, actually, most of the advice is no different from 10, 20, 30 years ago. I think, you know, make sure you're, you know, whereas you might say, make sure your portfolio is in good order, you might now say, make sure you have a, you know, good digital presence or a small website, or, you know, all that kind of sort of housekeeping stuff. The thing I think has changed is when I went for my interview as a UAL governor, it's quite a tough interview because it's quite a serious sort of trustee role, but they kept asking me what I thought the future of education was. And I kept saying, oh, I've got no idea. You know, I don't know. And they kept asking. And eventually I said, you're obviously, you know, concerned about this because you keep asking me, but I genuinely have no idea. And I don't think you should really appoint somebody that does know the answer to that question, because that probably means, you know, they're an education fanatic, which I don't think is what we want here. And I said, so I don't feel qualified to talk about that, but what I can talk about is the kind of people I'm hiring at the moment, and maybe that points to, you know, who, what we should be doing in university. And I said, one skill I'm looking for above all else is the ability to work in multidisciplinary teams, and the ability to break out of your specialism and work with other teams, because that is the only way you get things done these days, and that is the bigger, broader service design point of, you know, how good designs. I mean, I think this has always been the case, and I think this is a theme throughout my history, but I've always believed you can't do good design on your own. I mean, you can, but it's, that's borderline sort of art. I think if you want to make big projects and big change, you have to work with other people. So I'm looking for people that are naturally multidisciplinary. And I said, I think that's the thing, you know, we should do more of. We should do more of that in the college, and we should do more of that in education in general, really, and we should focus on that. And so my advice to people graduating now or about to graduate would be work in a multidisciplinary way, or find somebody you can do that with, and really make a big deal of that aspect of your skills, and I think you're more likely to get hired that way.
Well, that's really very good advice. Ben Tarrant, thank you very much for sharing us your RDI insights. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mike. I've really enjoyed it.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, there are almost 50 more in the RDI Insights archive. They feature major creative figures including Nick Park, Margaret Howe, Thomas Heatherwick, Betty Jackson, Paul Smith, and many, many more. Just tap RDI Insights into your browser.